Audi.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Now, in the late 90s, there were two travel books that inspired and really have continued to inspire a generation of travellers. Alex Garland's The Beach and William Sutcliffe's Are You Experienced, which I still reference regularly now. And I know from our conversations on social media, I've been chatting about this a lot on Facebook, that many of you really loved that book too. So it dawned on me that since this book crops up so much in my conversations with guests, I should actually get the author on the podcast. I don't know why it took me so long. He's still a very prolific author. In fact, his new book, The Gifted, The Talented and Me, is out just this week. So I'm really delighted to have persuaded him to come on the podcast and chat. Let's give William Sutcliffe the full Big Travel Podcast treatment. Over 20 years since it was published, William Sutcliffe's hilariously cynical take on people who go travelling is still inspiring travellers all over the world. He instantly regretted a solo trip to Pakistan to get the train to Beijing, was horrified by the realities of life on the West Bank, ate nothing but marmalade sandwiches for days when travelling to the remote salt flats in Bolivia, and yes, a lot of the stories in Are You Experienced are autobiographical, and yes, I do dare to ask him about that pretty graphic description of being unwell, shall we say, in India. William Sutcliffe is on the Big Travel Podcast.
I don't know whether to start with your new book, which is out today, which I have been reading and I've got right here, or my favourite book of yours, which is related directly to travel. I mean, obviously, the new book is just as good. Shall we start with the new book, actually? Tell me quickly about that.
Well, it all started, actually, with a conversation I had with a bookseller, my son, who was in his early teens at the time. He was ill in bed. And I thought, we've got a local shop where they know all the kids, and I'll go and find something light and funny for him to read. And you go, it's funny, you go and you're looking for a funny book for a teenager, and you ask for the bookseller. She said, has he read Adrian Mole? Yes. Has he read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Yes. And she said, for a teenage boy, that's it. And I thought, that's amazing. Those books are really old. And you look at the YA section, books for young people, and it's so dark.
They're the books that we were reading as kids.
Yeah, exactly. And those books are so funny. They meant such a lot to me when I was a kid. And that was before YA was invented. They weren't really seen as books for teenagers. But all my friends read them and all our mums read them. They're kind of books about teenage life. And they just crossed all boundaries. And I thought, why is nobody doing that? And I started writing funny books. You know, we'll go on to talk about our experience. And I hadn't really tried to write anything funny for a long time. And I just thought, living with teenagers is so funny. And they're such funny people, and they have this reputation for being dark. And yeah, they're really up and down, but for every down, there's an up. So it's a kind of funny, it's a funny novel. It's called The Gifted, The Talented Me, and it's a funny book about a teenager from a kind of very ordinary, from Stevenage. And suddenly his dad makes money, and they move to Hampstead, and they get put into the fictional North London Academy for the Gifted and Talented. And the hero of the book is not gifted or talented and doesn't want to be. He just wants to be ordinary. And he's in a school surrounded by kids who think they're amazing.
So we can all relate to that, I think, can't
there's
we?
There's a lot of that in our culture, isn't there? There's a kind of increasing, but I don't know if it's social media, talent shows or TV. There's this belief that we all have to be special. Everybody wants to be on stage. Nobody wants to be in the audience somehow these days. Everybody, and also with young people and social media, suddenly they're kind of performing. Everything is performed. They want to get likes and follows for things they do. And it doesn't seem quite right to me. So it's a funny book, but underneath it all, it's a slight satire on that change in our culture. So it's funny, if we're talking about two books, so this book compared to Are You Experienced, which I wrote in 1996 when I was in my 20s myself. And in that book, the character goes to India and he sends postcards home to his parents. That's the only way to communicate. So it's in my lifetime. It's not that much time historically, but it is another universe.
Oh, things have changed just so dramatically even in the last 10 years, haven't they?
Yeah, and the level of connectivity, it's brilliant in some ways, but in some ways I think it's detrimental relating to you know, there's a lot of talk about mental health of teenagers and it can be a bit pious, but I think there's something in that, that constant communication late into the evening, everybody has to know what everybody else is doing, these group chats, it's just very stressful and it's very hard for them to switch off.
It is very stressful, even for grown-ups, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And even when you travel, they don't switch off, they're always connected. And that's what's interesting now, you know, looking back at our experience, got kids going to India written a long time ago. I think one of the best things about travelling when you're young used to be that you were gone and you could leave your life behind. And to a certain extent, you could leave yourself behind. And that was part of the point about travel when you're a young person. And because you change so fast when you're young, but you're always often feel you're slightly held back by who you used to be last year. Your friends, your family, everybody around you knows who you are. And you feel like you want to change. You want to, what if I want to become somebody else, be somebody else? And that's natural and healthy. That's why those breaks when you go off to university or something are amazing. You can reinvent yourself if you want to. But travel used to be another opportunity to do that.
I guess it's curious with your online self, because you can reinvent yourself publicly every day if you like, but that's not reinventing yourself who you are. And if you do go travelling, you know, to India, like we're talking about, like we will be talking about in Are You Experienced, you can reinvent yourself physically. You know, there's nobody else that knows you. You don't have that online presence. You might not speak to your parents for like a week or 2 weeks, and that's all gone.
Yeah, and you make friends so fast when you're travelling. You move from place to place. And the book's sort of a satire on that, in the way young people, when they're travelling, they cling together. And Lonely Planet is as much a guide to India, or wherever you happen to be, as a guide to where to find the other Westerners in India. How to find people like you on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And it says, go to such and such hotel. And you make, when you're young, you make a beeline for that hotel. Not really because you think it's the best hotel, but it's because that's where, you know, everybody else who's got the Lonely Planet will be.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
You meet up, and you can, you know, I satirise that in the book, but that's not to say I didn't do that when I was 19, 20. And it's great. You arrive in Bangalore or wherever it is, and maybe you're on your own, maybe you're in one other person, but if you find a gang of like-minded people, it's kind of exciting. And in terms of the reinventing yourself, especially if you're travelling on your own, you really can. You meet new people and they don't know anything about you, and you can try on new selves. And that's, I think, something you should do when you're young. I think that's one of the fantastic things about travel for young people. And I worry that that element of it is lost.
It's definitely
when
changed.
When your parents and your family, you know, if they don't get a text message from you every 24 hours, you worry. I was travelling in the 90s, you'd send a postcard home and you'd literally get a letter back by poste restante. I don't
yes.
know if you ever did
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no,
that?
I never used poste restante, but I've heard people talk about it on the podcast.
Well, any young person listening to this probably has no idea what that means, but it used to be you'd send a postcard home, because international phone calls are really expensive then. You know, a night in a hotel would cost you 10 seconds of phoning home or something. It would rack up, so you wouldn't do it, and you wouldn't really be expected to do it when you're travelling on a budget. So you'd maybe give your parents a rough itinerary before you left, but that would be fluid. You might not tell them. You'd send them a postcard home, and you'd literally say, I'm going to be... And the postcard would take 10 days to get home or something. You say, OK, in 2 or 3 weeks' time, I'm going to be in Kathmandu. So they would send a letter to William Sutcliffe, Poste Restante, Kathmandu. And you arrive in Kathmandu, you go to the central post office, and you say, can I have Poste Restante for the letter S? Sutcliffe, and they give you this massive box. Yes, you know, there's a lot. They give you a massive box, and you look through all of these letters from all over the world, and if you're lucky, there'd be one for your parents. And I still have that feeling, you step out on the street and there would be a letter
such a
from
buzz,
home.
Wasn't it? It was such a buzz getting a written card or... Yeah. Well, actually, on the subject of that, I've been talking about this on my Facebook page, because when I picked up your book, knowing I was going to interview you, and the reason I wanted to interview was because I actually still reference this book at least once every few episodes on my podcast. You know, I've probably read it a couple of times then, you know, I've probably read it more than once, but I last read it in the year 2000 maybe, and I'm still referencing it now because it just so captured the essence of travellers at the time, and maybe they're still like that now. And I was one of the people that couldn't afford to go travelling and never managed to save up. I managed to get to Amsterdam and spend 10 months there and come back with my tail between my legs, definitely a lot poorer, a lot tired. Amsterdam has that effect on you. But I picked up this book and it's got a dedication in it from one of my best friends, who's still one of my best friends now. And she bought it for me on my 25th birthday in 1999. And actually, this was in the middle of my Amsterdam experience. I'd come back to Brighton for the summer and for a couple of weeks, and it was actually not a great time in my life. But when you when you're that age and younger, you know, obviously you were in your 20s when you wrote this, you can really, you have all these hopes and dreams, don't you? And part of that is doing this whole travel experience around the world. And, you know, if you can't do it, you're pretty pissed off. And I, you know, have done it since, but not in that way. But you really captured the traveller's experience, you know, the wankers, the public school boys, the rich kids, the people that are like pretending to be hippies when they've got trust funds, the people who have really have saved up to go on their own. You really captured all these people. And I'm guessing it's because you did the whole thing yourself.
Yeah, I think the starting point for it was I went on my year off, like a lot of people, I had a year off before university, and I worked for 6 months. It's actually still the best job I've had in my life. I worked in the jazz section of the HMV shop on Oxford Street, selling records. I just lucked out. I went for a job and they put me in that section with a colleague who was a fantastic guy. And I racked up some money, and then I had the summer and I'd earned a decent amount of money, and I didn't really know where to go. And then a little bit like in the book, quite different. There was somebody who I knew was going, and I was sort of dragged along by somebody else's passion for India to go, even though I didn't know a huge amount about it. I liked the idea of the adventure. And also it was a girl who I fancied, a little bit like in the book.
It's although a bit autobiographical.
Well, kind of. The story is also, but the characters aren't, actually, in the sense that I went and I had an absolutely fantastic time, loved it, did fall out with the person I was travelling with. That didn't go right, a bit like in the book, but again, very different. And absolutely loved it. And then went back. And then actually, when I was at university, I managed to save up some more money and get a travel grant to go to Pakistan afterwards. Because I thought, this is great. I want to go more hardcore and do something similar. And we can talk about that later. That was an astonishing trip. And I absolutely loved Pakistan. This was before it was perceived as dangerous. And I went right up to the Afghanistan border and to some of the places now that are pretty dangerous for Western. Anyway, I loved Pakistan. And then I just actually, unlike the character in the book who hates it, I really loved it. But when I went back and I was old and I went to India a few years later in my sort of early mid-20s and saw the younger people, about 19, and they were only sort of 3 or 4 years younger than me. But I could sort of see in them, I'd looked at them and I saw how they were behaving and I thought, oh my God, that is probably what I was like.
It's a massive difference at that age, isn't it? It really is a massive difference.
Yeah, and like them, I don't think I had much self-awareness when I was 19. But then just a few years older, I could look back and this kind of horror version, what I might have been at my most pretentious and ridiculous, I suddenly saw the joke in that and the humour in that, and I thought that could be a really funny book. So it's like that. So the character in the book is a sort of self-flagellating version of my worst imagination of what I might have been. And it's also split. Also, I realised that in terms of the satire on travellers in India, there are kind of two responses to India which are equally ridiculous. One is, you love everything. You think Indians are spiritual people. You start wearing, you know, Hindu or Buddhist clothes. And the other is, I hate everything. It's terrifying. Everything's so dirty. What am I doing here? And so, yeah, there are elements of me in there, but in a way, the two characters in the book, the guy and the girl and it, they arrive in India and they're kind of into each other and they have those two polar opposite responses. You know, I was somewhere in the middle. I had a bit of both.
Yeah,
he hates everything. She loves everything. And they're both equally misguided. And this causes them to completely fall out. And what was interesting about the reaction to the book is I sort of thought it was pretty niche, really. Not that many people do it. And it's definitely been a hit for the people that do it. It's become a sort of alternative guidebook. And, you know, one of the things I'm proudest of in all the 20 years I've been writing is that in The Lonely Planet, at the back, even though the book massively takes the piss out of Lonely Planet, the recent editions of The Lonely Planet have a list of the novels you have to read when you go to India. And there's only about five or six novels, I think. And one is Midnight's Children, and one is Are You Experienced? I'm so delighted about that.
Yeah,
fantastic.
I mean, I interviewed Monisha Rajesh, who's written around India in AZ Trains and around the world in AZ Trains. She was like, that is my favourite book about India.
Oh, really?
Because it does, it sums up the two polar opposites. I mean, I love India and I hate it as well. It's horrible, it's hard work, it's dirty. You know, you're washing your top in the sink and it's going browner and browner, you know, and there are some really tough times, you know, when you're travelling in India. Yeah. And I'm someone who's lucky enough to have been to India several times, but on luxury press trips, you know, where everything is done for you, and you still get the bad stomach, you know, and you've got a great, like, scene in Are You Experienced where you shit yourself in a hostel, basically. It's just so graphic. I don't even know if I want to ask. I don't think I've ever asked a guest before, have you ever shat yourself in a hostel? But did you really shit yourself in a hostel?
It's a long time ago. The chapter in the book is fiction, I'm at pains to add. I had various grumbles. I didn't have it as bad as him, but you hear stories, and I thought I turned it up to 11 with that chapter. It's an experience that everybody either has or hears about, and I thought I'd go try and go for the ultimate version. The people that go to India get it, and what really took me by surprise is actually, because he hates it so much, it seems to strike a chord with people who have no intention of going to India, are terrified of going to India, and they can have it all confirmed by the book. You know, some people are fascinated. Some people just think, I like travel, but I want to go to Spain. I don't really want to do third world travel. If that's how you feel, fine. And I think those people, in some ways, they feel comforted by the book because they read the book and think, okay, I don't have to do that. I've read about it now. It's not for me.
Let's move on a little bit, because I could talk about the book forever. And, you know, having flicking through it last night, there's so many laugh out loud moments there on every paragraph, which is a real skill, you know, as a writer. And it's a real testament that it's still, you know, being talked about so much now. So you went to Pakistan shortly after India, was it?
Yeah, that was a real life-changing trip, the thing I did after India, because I did it on my own. I suppose the long story about this is that I had that trip in my year off, then I went to university, and again I got a job over, the HMV was still hiring, I got a job over Christmas, and then I heard that at the university there was a travel grant if you could, you know, these weird people leave a legacy for some weird fund, and I just heard,
really?
If you write an
application. No, I thought they left it to, like, Battersea Dogs Home or something.
Well, they do, there were these strange things, a grant if you could write a proposal for a trip that you would write up of historical importance. And I wrote some proposal about the Silk Road and la la la. I just wanted to do the trip. And my elder brother had been there and told me about it. This Karakoram, you ever heard the Karakoram Highway?
No, I haven't. I know the Silk Road, but not the
And Karakoram. The Karakoram Highway is this modern road, which is fascinating. So, and it's all there because of geopolitical reasons and the old diplomatic thing about how your enemy's enemy is your friend. You know, China has a long going border dispute with India high up in the Himalayas. It never really gets talked about. It's even north of kind of Kashmir. If you look on a map, that India-China border is usually done as a dotted line. It's a ceasefire line, and they don't actually fight over it, but they are in dispute over that border. India-Pakistan, as everybody knows. Historic enemies. So for that reason, China and Pakistan are allies. The Pakistan-China border is in the Karakorams, which is very high, remote. The westernmost extension of the Himalayas is the Karakoram range, and it's geologically very new, very high, very spiky, and there's almost nothing there, very little there, very underpopulated. But for military reasons, they've built this, and China and Pakistan have built this incredible road. It's high quality, they call the Karakoram Highway, and there's even a guidebook to the Karakoram Highway. And so as a traveller, this is an amazing opportunity to get, there's quite easy access to this incredibly remote place. And I had to write, in order to get this grant, it had to be quite an ambitious trip. And also I felt like I slightly wanted to kind of toughen myself up. I was brought up not in luxury, but in a kind of North London semi-detached house. In a way, it's quite, all my dad's a sort of middle manager. It's quite ordinary, but it's not tough. And I had a sense that I want to be a writer and I need to sort of toughen myself up. I need to do something a bit challenging. Having been to India, I felt that's a real challenge doing that. And so I managed to write this grant, and I got the grant plus the money I'd earned from working in a shop. I had enough money over that first summer holiday of college to do this trip where I bought a one-way ticket to Karachi and a return ticket for 2 months later from Beijing by train on my own, which seems crazy now. If my son, my kids says they want to do that when they're 19, I don't know what I'll think.
Yeah, but that's it. When you become a parent, you see it differently.
Yeah, I just wanted to do it. And this was before Russia had invaded. So this was 92. Russia had already invaded Afghanistan. So Afghanistan was a no-no. And now the Mujahideen existed. But it was before in the West it was perceived as a hotspot. And I remember landing in Karachi, age 19, on my own with this ticket. You know, this is a long time ago, so it was a paper ticket. If I lost that bit of paper, I don't know how I would have got home. I had in my money belt this train ticket saying Beijing to Moscow, August to something, end of August. And that night, I've probably never been more scared in my life, actually. I was up for it and I was feeling brave until I got there. And I remember landing in Karachi, and it's quite a huge and quite scary city, boiling hot. And I still remember vividly that first night in a hotel in Karachi. And I just picked a hotel. There were no other Westerners in this hotel. I was on my own. I was far away. The only way back was to get to Beijing, I don't know, 3,000 miles away or something. I was absolutely terrified. I thought, what have I done? And so I got out of Karachi quite fast and got on the train north. And slowly, quite quickly, I fell in love with Pakistan. Once I was in the north and I was up in the mountains, and I still remember arriving in Peshawar, which is now a very dangerous place for travellers. You hear of kidnaps there, and because there are that northernmost part of Pakistan, which is still called the sort of tribal areas, has never quite been reined into the democracy. Mm. They're sort of the Pashtuns, they're pretty wild people, and it's where the British Empire had to stop there. Nobody has ever been able to tame them, and there's guns, and it's an absolutely crazy place. And you see the houses, they're like this kind of military compounds. You know, the British could conquer anywhere, yeah. But not there. Mm. They just couldn't pin them down. And once I got up there, I was absolutely fine. And it was, weirdly enough, the most hospitable place I've ever been to. I remember going to a market in Peshawar, and it's a bit like going to a market in India, when everyone says, come in, take tea. But there, they come and say, come in, take tea, and you go in, you have a cup of tea. And then they don't try and sell you a rug. They say, okay, bye.
Oh, and that's a relief, yeah. Actually.
And there was that. So just people wanted to chat. And I still remember once sitting down in a restaurant having a meal. And then when I tried to pay the bill, somebody just said, no, that guy over there, he's paid your bill. And this guy just kind of waved at me. And that was that. It was just this incredible hostility.
Nobody tried
hostility.
To perforate your eardrum. I remember being in a market, I think it was Bangalore, actually, where somebody came at me with like a thing that they wanted to stick in my ear, and I had to sort of stop them from sticking this dagger in my ear. It was like, clean your ears. It was like, my ear's fine.
Oh, the ear cleaning.
Yeah. And then you read about it in The Lonely Planet afterwards. It's like, don't. They'll perforate your eardrums. Like, oh, yeah. Thank God I avoided that.
And it will give you hepatitis or something.
Yes, yeah. I don't know which is worse. Actually.
Yeah. but that was a fascinating place and an astonishing trip.
So how did the train trip go? Or did you stop off?
That was part of the trip. So yeah, it was bit by bit. So I went slowly up through Pakistan and went right up to the Khyber Pass, which was quite amazing.
Amazing.
There's a legendary place right on the border, which has been well known since Victorian times as a gun making place. I remember a German guy was very keen to go there. And I thought, okay. And so we went, again, it is like the Wild West. Went to this village, and it really was like the Wild West, just a dusty street and these wooden shacks. Except in this one town, for no reason, every shop was selling guns. And this guy who I was with, I realised he was really into guns.
Oh, great.
And I thought that's why he was there. And then I remember these guys came to the shop and gave us a card and said, come with us, adventure trip, come in the mountains and fire off a Kalashnikov with the Mujahideen. And I thought, actually, voluntarily going into the mountains with the Mujahideen who've told you they've got an assault rifle with them, probably not. So I didn't go for that. I met people who did, actually, but I didn't go for that.
I'm sure. In Phnom Penh, I was offered to fire a Kalashnikov just after visiting the killing fields. And loads of tourists or travellers, as they might call themselves, like, yeah, great, I'll go. And, no, I'm not doing it.
It's strange, isn't it? But what was interesting about that, there aren't that many places that are that you can go, even in my lifetime, which are completely untouristed, but that was astonishing. And the landscape up there is absolutely beautiful. And going right up, and the closer you get to the Chinese border, the more wild it gets. And then you go over the border, and the first thing over the border on the other side is one of the most amazing places I've ever been, a place called Kashgar. So as a travel podcast, this is a niche place, but if anyone wants to do some really extraordinary travel, Kashgar is absolutely amazing. So you've got the Taklamakan Desert, which is the western extension of the Gobi Desert, and it's absolutely enormous. The last town in the far southwest of China is Kashgar, and it's the Uyghurs, they're called, U-I-Y-G-U-R, who are the Muslims of western China. It's this huge area of China which was traditionally Muslim and culturally totally different from Han China, and they're actually terribly oppressed by the Chinese, particularly now. It's getting worse and worse, and people, you know, there's a lot of awareness about Tibet, very little about that, even more so now actually. So back then it was probably not quite as bad as it is now, but this Kashgar market, because it's a desert, and then you've got Afghanistan, it's right near the border with Afghanistan and Pakistan, so it's just right at the edge. You know, there's kind of that amazing buzz you get from frontier towns. This is the edge of China, but it's a more sort of edge place than anywhere you could ever go, because it's so far from everywhere apart from these other borders, which aren't particularly porous anyway. So it covers, and they have this Sunday market which effectively covers an area the size of Western Europe. It's the market for this vast land area. And throughout the desert, there are these... It's not like the Sahara. It's not empty. There are villages all over. So the Suzhou people just come. And you could be... You feel like you could be at any point in the last 200 years. It's a cattle market, a horse market, extraordinary food for sale. And I still remember the look for all Uyghur men is, for some reason, a shaven head and a goatee beard, almost all, and a particular kind of fur hat. I remember seeing rows and rows of guys like that, all getting the head shaved, these barbers, rows and rows of them shaving the heads of these people. You know those moments where travel just totally takes you out of everything you've ever seen before? And you're like, if I had to pick one kind of all the traveling I've done in the 48 years of my life, that one day is probably the most amazing, walking around Kashgar market. Absolutely astonishing. And then from Kashgar, you have to get to reach the first railway in China. You have to get one bus journey to the next town, which literally takes 3 days from Kashgar to Urumqi. 3 days up through. And then once you get in Urumqi, you're on the Chinese rail network and you're kind of connected to the rest of the world. So that's that, you know, that's how remote Kashgar is. It's 3 days in a bus to the nearest railway station. And then actually in China, I had a rough time in China. Having loved Pakistan, the trip through China, I found it very tough. And I was alone. And you know, when you're that age, it's brilliant to travel on your own. But it was pretty young for that trip.
Yeah.
And the highs were high, but the lows were pretty low actually.
What was the funniest thing that happened to you? I'm going in the middle of the highs and the lows. What was the most amusing thing? I did nothing amusing.
I'm trying to think, actually. Maybe that weird day with the German gun obsessive in Pakistan. But I remember the weird thing, the really weird awakening. There was a weird awakening crossing the border from Pakistan into China. Pakistan was, despite the history, seemed to be an amazing warmth and positivity towards, I'm not sure it was all foreigners, but towards British people. I did see a kind of Saddam is Superman, Death to America t-shirt for sale when I was there.
The politics
were still there, but there was, on the personal, whatever the geopolitics might have been happening, yes, because the Gulf War had happened then, the personal warmth was really powerful and welcoming, and you could just make connect, and also a lot of people speak English, so the connection was great. Kashgar was like another universe. It wasn't like being in China. But the minute I left Kashgar, I was suddenly in China, and you felt it was absolutely flipped the other way. The Chinese people had been taught a lot of hostility towards the West, and I felt it had really taken. I felt straight away that I wasn't welcome. And this is when communist China was communist. And so there was that amazing, genuinely communist, demotivated atmosphere. So I suppose, for younger listeners who never lived through communism, there was a thing that's probably gone now completely. Just you'd go into a hotel and the person behind the desk would be a government employee. And there was an attitude, I don't know if it was just a sense of hostility to Westerners or this, but this absolutely spiky go away. And sometimes you'd go in and you'd ask for room and they just say no. The first word of Chinese you learn is mayo, for no. And they just say no. And what you realise you had to do is you had to go up into the hotel, and as a traveller there would be these dormitories. You'd go up, you'd claim a bed, and then you'd come back down and you'd have to find a way of communicating to them that you've taken a bed. And then they would very reluctantly accept your money.
It's very difficult to find that sort of foreignness these days. I mean, it does exist in some places, but like you said, the whole communism thing, I remember going to places in Eastern Europe that felt very, very foreign and frosty and cold. You know, the people were cold. I'm not saying they all are, but, you know, that's how it felt. You know, they were conditioned to hate us.
Yeah, and the level of mistrust, actually, it's weird being mistrusted like that.
And also not necessarily mistrusted or hated as well, but just not a different kind of, you know, we're overly polite, aren't we, when we travel, British people, yes, American people, yeah. We go out of our way, you know, there's no way you'd sit behind a reception and just go no.
And I mean, in some ways you can feel a sneaking admiration for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The total
yeah.
absence of any ingratiating effort. But the amount that China has changed, so if, what year was that? So if that was 92 or 93, it's interesting, my memory, and then I ended up in Beijing, and at that point it was dominated by bicycles. I mean, I haven't been back to Beijing, but I've seen pictures now, and it's such a modern city, more modern cities than most
really
Western cities, and cars and superhighways. And the fact that in that tiny gap of time, I mean, literally going down cycling, you cycle towards Tiananmen Square. I still remember, you can't really imagine it, you never experienced it in the West, a big, wide boulevard. And everyone would ride the same make of bike that didn't have gears. So all the bikes go at roughly the same speed, not fast, not slow. And you'd be in this morass, almost like a picture you see of the London Marathon or something. Mm. Just a mass of people, and they all move at the same speed, and the traffic lights go red, and everybody stops. And just huge numbers of bicycles. And now totally, totally, I mean, the transformation in that city is just astonishing.
You wrote, you talk about like the bad times when travelling, and do you think there's something, there's another scene in Are You Experienced where the guy's at Dave, it's Dave, isn't it?
Yeah.
Dave is sitting on the beach. I think he's sitting on the beach, and everything around his life has fallen apart. He's sitting there and he's thinking, this is absolutely disastrous, and then starts to cry. And in that moment, he kind of realises, actually, this is really good. You know, this sort of terrible hardship that I've brought upon myself is actually almost life-affirming and makes you look a bit more interesting. You know, his cheekbones are chiselled, where he's lost weight with the terrible shitting himself incident, and you know, he knows that he looks like a tortured soul and actually feels like, you know, he's grown a little bit, or maybe he hasn't, because he's thinking it from a shallow point of view. It's like, I look like a tortured soul, you know, I'm quite enjoying this, looking like a tortured soul. Is there something about those sort of lows and hardships when you travel that like makes you feel good about yourself?
Exactly. I suppose that scene came from some of those feelings I had in that longer trip, where I really pushed myself to the point of fear and slightly beyond. Yeah, I did sort of bit off more than I could chew in a certain way. Yeah, and in a sense, you know, that's sort of a satirical scene in a way, but something I think we've all felt. He feels down, and then he has a sort of outer body, he can see himself from the outside, and he thinks that it looks cool to be down.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he feels happy that he must be looking cool, and then he's up. And it's sort of a satire on just how when you're 18, your emotions are just everywhere, up, down, up, down.
And even earlier than that, I remember writing a diary, you know, and I was living in Spain at the time, and I'd go off on the rocks for hours on my own and sit and write, you know, deep thoughts. And part of that was I wanted someone to come across me sitting there writing deep thoughts. You know, I wanted to like be that person who is like, you know, here I am on my own, I'm sad, you've hurt me, I'm thinking deep thoughts.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing.
I know, that's a funny thing with teenagers. Yeah, my eldest he's 15 now, so he's a bit young for this, but you do get the thing with teenagers. It's funny, teenagers coming back into my life now for the first time since I was one. And there's something funny. It's a very interesting period of life emotionally, and there is that, there's a kind of an urge to be more complicated than you are.
Definitely.
And sadder than you are.
And it's dreadful if you've had like a great upbringing like you and I have both. So it's like we've had no hardship whatsoever. It's like what can we create for ourselves here?
Although the interpersonal stuff is so intense. So it's funny, I think the other reason why that book struck a chord with people who've never done that kind of travel and never want to, and I didn't realise this when I was writing it, is that the really universal experience there is going on holiday with somebody and falling out with them. And if you're in India or Greece or Costa Brava, it's the same thing.
And you know, I would say more about the book itself. It's just that universal sort of young person experience. It doesn't even have to be in India. It can be sitting on a rock down the road from, you know, where you live, like I was. It doesn't have to be anywhere. Another book that you wrote was The Wall, and that was based in Israel and Palestine on about the wall. It was about, you know, the West Bank. Did you go there and research it, or did you just sort of conjure it up in your
No, I did. Eye? There was a long and complicated intellectual and emotional journey behind that book, actually. I'm Jewish myself, but not from a Zionist or religious family particularly. But if you're Jewish, you feel you have to have an opinion about Israel. And I wasn't brought up to feel either positive or negative towards it particularly. And my family, my father's father is an English Gentile, which is why I'm called Sutcliffe, but my other three grandparents are all Lithuanian Jews. And there was a mass exodus of Lithuanians. It's actually the biggest mass movement of Jews prior to the Holocaust in history was the pogroms in the Pale of Settlement, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, mainly Lithuania and Latvia, in the dying days of the Tsarist Empire, to try and save himself. He tried to blame everything on the Jews, which, as often in history, it worked, and a lot of Jews fled, and a lot of Lithuanian Jews ended up in South Africa. You know, if somebody you knew would be there, so you'd send your son. So my family went from Lithuania to South Africa. My mother was brought up in South Africa and then came to England in the 60s, but as a white South African, had quite a lot of guilt about her upbringing. And I went and I'd visited my grandparents in South Africa when I was little, and then in my early 20s, thinking I need to have an opinion about Israel, see what I think. And also having travelled in Pakistan and spent some time in Muslim countries and found it very interesting, I went on a trip with my girlfriend at the time to Israel, and also went down into the Sinai Peninsula, which is, you know, it's part of Egypt, and through Jordan and then back again, so get a feel for Israel and the area. And I came away with some very positive feelings towards Israel, which I'd never felt before, and also some very negative impressions, including an uneasy sense, reminded me of South Africa in some ways, two populations cheek by jowl, one with very, very different set of rights and privileges to another. And I stayed, when I was in Jerusalem, I stayed in East Jerusalem more than West Jerusalem, which is the Palestinian side, and I felt uneasy about it. But I didn't continue to think deeply about Israel for a long time until I had this idea for a book, The Wall, actually when The Wall was being built, I became interested in it as a writer, actually. I think it seemed to me like a very interesting metaphor for lots of what's going on. It seems like a hugely important thing in our time in general is the world is increasingly getting divided into haves and have-nots. And there's that wall, but there's also the way that EU is a form of wall in a way that we are all behind. Who's on this side of the wall, the privileged side of the wall, the unprivileged side? You know, there's America, and walls seem to be coming back.
Yeah,
more,
Trump's
and borders. And the physical concrete wall there in the West Bank seemed like a physical embodiment of that. And I began to think, what if I write a story set in a kind of loosely based on the wall there, and the story of the sort of plot of the book is a teenager from one side of the wall has been brought up in effectively a version of an Israeli settlement, has been brought up believing that everybody on the side of the wall is evil and bad, and they're our enemy, and they want to get us, so we need the wall to keep us safe, which is essentially the narrative, the Israeli narrative of the wall. But this kid, in pursuit of a lost football, finds a hidden passageway, goes through, and the people on the other side, some people try and get him because they know who he is and where he's from, and then a girl hides him, saves him for her own reasons, and helps him get back. And via this connection with the girl, he realises that the picture's much more complicated than he thought. And he realises at the last minute that this girl is in desperate need. She's really hungry. And he feels that that she's in real trouble and he has to find a way to help her. And the initial notion I had was quite sort of metaphorical, loosely based on that place. And then the more research I did, the more I read about it, the more I began to have some ethical issues with how do you go about loosely basing something on a real place. And then I heard about this thing, the Palestine Festival of Literature, where Western writers go to Palestine, to the West Bank, and they travel around with Palestinians and they do events to Palestinian audiences. And because it's so hard to move around there for the local population, because the occupation, the festival moves around. It's sort of like a road show, and you go to. And I wrote them a letter explaining this book, saying I'd love to participate. And it's run by the brilliant Egyptian writer Adaf Suef, and she invited me on, and I went on that trip, and then I saw it all firsthand, and I was absolutely kicked in the stomach by it, actually. And I realised that what I saw on that trip was so different from what I'd seen on a sort of tourist trip to Israel when I was younger. Mm. And I was absolutely horrified by what I saw, and I saw the occupation for what it was for the first time in my life. It's just the brutality of it, the injustice of it, and what the wall has done to people's lives, and also the incredible dignity of the people there. Just a deeply, deeply traumatised people, and how you psychologically carry on with your life in the face of despair, because they're just losing and they're continuing to lose and they are so powerless and it's not getting better. And I came back and I looked at this manuscript and I just thought, I can't continue. I don't know what to do with this. And for quite a while, I couldn't carry on. I thought, I can't piggyback off other people's misery to write this book. But slowly I found a way back into it. I thought, okay, I can write this book and it can seem, and I realised I could do a sort of split, it's sort of two books in one. So in some ways it's a young adult book that reads, I realise I could write this, but it reads to young people who know nothing about it. It reads like a dystopia of the kind of book that young adult fiction has, lots of dystopia set in a fantastical universe with mm-hmm. rich people and poor people divided by a wall. It feels like one of those young adult dystopias, but I did more and more meticulous research and made it, and actually it's almost reportage. The facts of it and the logistics of the colours of the number plates, the how you get a pass to get through the wall, the people being denied access to farmland, olive groves, the farming of the olive groves. There's a whole plot pivots on an olive grove that this family has that needs to be watered, but they can't get there anymore. And I did, and eventually I found a way around it. I found a way to honour the subject, I think. So it's very detailed, and it's had an excellent response, to my huge relief, from Palestinian readers and people who lived there. Hopefully they feel seen by it. Obviously, you know, they're the people that should be telling their own story. But in the outside world, there's so little appetite for hearing that story. And I think I found a way, you know, it's not had an enormous readership, but the people who have read it, it communicates some of what it's really like.
It's funny, I see a lot of people speaking out about Israel from both sides. Maybe it's just the social media I inhabit, you know, and the people, the journalists and writers that are around me, at least the people that are around me, you know, in the virtual universe online. And it's a controversial thing, writing about Israel, because so many people are so, so pro-Israel. And yeah. I don't understand how they can be that pro-Israel when such dreadful things are happening in Palestine. I had friends, I haven't been to, I've been to Israel, I haven't been to Palestine, but I've had friends that have lived there and, you know, living like you have and travelled there and living amongst these people that are just so oppressed. It just seems bizarre that you can be in any way against that when you think about the people on the ground who are living with that on a day-to-day basis, and it seemingly doesn't seem to be getting any better.
Yes, and when you see it, I mean, there's something about, I found there's a huge difference in reading about it and seeing it. The word military occupation trips off the tongue, but when you actually see it, when you actually go through a checkpoint and you see, you know, a middle-aged Palestinian doctor up against a 19-year-old Israeli with a gun, and if the guy with the gun says, no, yeah, you've got a pass, but actually no, go back that way, and you go back that way. Just the power of the gun and of the military, and not the stuff that's on the news. I mean, that's the thing I really learned then. What you see, and I think this is where you can have the role of fiction can depict this in an interesting different way to current affairs. A gun is news when it's fired, and the bullet goes somewhere and hits something. That's news. But what isn't news is the power of the unfired gun. And that's what I saw there, really, the enormous power. When you have people with guns and another group of people who don't have guns, the people without guns have to do. That's what's happening on a daily basis. there, being living under military occupation, and you meet, you know, it's been occupied since 1967. So people, you know, in their 60s who've lived their whole life under military occupation, they do not have those rights. But travel-wise, the other interesting thing I realised as I was writing, but having had that visceral experience, because the book is written from the point of view of a kid who lives in a settlement, I realised also, I mean, the other thing, writing a novel about it, as you were saying, the defence of Israel is so visceral from the people who want to defend Israel. As I was writing this book, I realised that unlike any other novel I'm ever going to write, the book has to be armour-plated against attack. There are going to be people, it's not just, I don't like your novel. There are going to be people who want to undermine it, attack it, if they see the book as attacking Israel, which on some level it is. It's criticising the occupation, which as I see it is legitimate, but you have to armour plate it against that. And I realise that I really do need to see both sides of this properly to write it accurately and fairly. And having been on this trip through Palestine and seen the settlements from the outside, which can appear very fortified, forbidding, terrifying, always on the hilltops, because that's the land they've taken. Because historically, obviously, in a dry place, you don't settle in the hilltops because the water is down below. But for military reasons now, so all these settlements, they can drill big boreholes, they can get water in. They've occupied the hilltops, often on the grounds that they were unoccupied. Nobody wanted them anyway, which is historically a lot. It's just very inaccurate and a spurious justification. And I always thought it was impossible to, how do you visit a settlement? It's kind of impossible as an outsider, but I did actually find a way. There's one very left-wing Israeli tour company called Green Olive Tours, and I hugely recommend it to anyone who's visiting Israel on any kind of random tourist trip. You look on the Green Olive Tours website and they do day tours of the West Bank. So you can be staying in Israel, you can be on a nice family holiday to Tel Aviv, you can still look on the Green Olive Tours, give yourself at least one day where you see what's really going on one other side. And Green Olive Tours are the people to go to that. They even do day tours of the old city of Jerusalem, where they will point out to you what a normal Israeli tour guide will not point out to you. Mm. They will say, this here didn't used to be here. This is what was bulldozed to make this. And it's a revelation. You see, you see that house there. Those people are settlers and they chuck their rubbish into that courtyard there and all sorts of stuff like that.
I will do that. If I manage to get there again, I will do that. But I went there for a party on a boat and went down the Sinai Peninsula and I thought it was a great place. I really loved it and the food is incredible. And it was very awkward crossing borders, especially because I'd taken the boat from Israel down to Egypt and then came back over land. That was very difficult to explain and that there's a lot of heavy, heavy security. They took our passports away for quite a long time and it felt quite nerve-wracking, you know, other than that, obviously just saw no trouble whatsoever, which you don't, you know, in those places.
I know, you have to, and it's very, and that's the interesting thing about the wall, but is that it's very Alice in Wonderland. It's, you go on the Palestinian side, as I did, and it is everywhere, you can't escape it. And then I went on the second trip to try and see the wall from the other side, you can't find it. It's an amazing piece of architecture. It's hidden, it's deliberate in your face on one side, and on the other side it's disguised by trees, it's hidden back from the road. There are land banks pushed up it, so when you can see it, it's 8 metres high on one side, 8 metres, twice as high as the Berlin Wall, or more than twice as high as the Berlin Wall, 8 metres, it's enormous. And it looks half the size from the other side because they push these land bucks at it, they put stone things on it to decorate it. And what Green Olive Tours set up for me is a private trip into settlements, which they do occasionally. It's usually just journalists and diplomats that want to see it. And via Green Olive Tours, I managed to get this tour where I stayed in some settlements, and that was absolutely bizarre. One of the families was a family from New Jersey who'd moved there for ideological reasons, and in a way they're very like families I know from Golders Green. They were nice people, they were warm, they were friendly, but they were settlers. They believed they were doing God's work in moving to this place. And I remember asking, and they had kids, I remember saying to him, why, how do you feel about bringing up your kids so close to the wall? And he said, oh, we have walls like that next to the freeways in New Jersey. We call them sound barriers. So they were amazingly deluded about what was going on. They really didn't. They didn't get it. But what's interesting in these things, again, as a writer of fiction, is ideologically, I despise what they're doing, but they're not evil. I mean, that's the thing. They were nice people. That's the interesting thing. As human beings, most of the human beings you come across are personable, even though, in my opinion, they were doing something really appalling. And obviously there's a spectrum of settlements. There are some real rabid, terrifying, crazy ones who I avoided. So the ones I met were more at the milder end, but they're still, you know, they're occupying this land against international law.
It just goes to show that I think you cannot have a valid pro-Israel stance if you haven't been there. And I don't mean where I've been, to Tel Aviv and Eilat and all these wonderful places, to actually, you know, behind the wall, next to the wall, on the other side of the wall, and seen how people are living with the reality of it.
I think few people get it. They don't really understand it. And I mean, and I understand, because I'm Jewish myself, I absolutely understand the history of it. I think I'm in an unusual position, actually, in that I can understand both sides. And I think that puts me in an interesting position as a novelist. But having seen both sides, and I think really tried really hard to understand both sides, I have ended up with a very clear sense of what's right and wrong here. And the occupation is just wrong. And the way Israel keeps on lurching further and further to the right, and the two-state solution, even if it's just totally receding, Oslo is a joke. It was the one you really understand. It was kind of a con, in a sense. It's so tragic when you're in Palestine. The injustice is so in your face, and it's heartbreaking, actually.
Now, I'd love to talk about it. I can talk about it for ages, but we're going to run out of time. So what other big travel hits in your life have I not mentioned?
Alongside kind of Kashgar Market, the other extraordinary, one of the most extraordinary things that I've ever seen, which is also really unheard of, is the, have you ever heard of the Salar de Urumqi in Bolivia?
It's the salt plains. Oh, my God, I'd love to go there. Yeah, absolutely love to go there.
It's really astonishing.
They look incredible.
Yeah, and for some reason, I mean, because it's so hard to get to, it's not spoken about much. It's very little known.
It looks like the moon, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does in photos.
I believe it's the... I'm a sceptic of anyone who says such and such is the size of Wales.
Everything's the size of Wales. Or 10 football pitches. I don't know how many football pitches get into Wales, or indeed the salt plains in Olivia.
Exactly. It's a universal measurement of size for something big but not that big. Mm. So it's that size. But it's just white and flat. It's like a piece of paper. And you cannot believe your eyes when you go there. So you go right up to the north of Chile, through the Atacama Desert, and then again, I think you have to drive for 2 or 3 days in a car. You can get, when you get to the last town in Atacama, and you pay for a sort of a jeep ride, a 3-day jeep trip to the Salar de Uyuni, and then it pops you out in Bolivia on the other side. So it's right, I think, Atacama. It's one of these places where it hasn't rained for 200 years or something, and then you go up from there into the Altiplano, the high plains of Bolivia. So it's really high, really remote, and totally uninhabited. So you drive for several days through the desert, and you have to stay in these terrible lodges. And I remember the only thing to eat was bread and marmalade for some reason. It was, in some ways, it was the worst trip. It was really,
you see where
grim.
Paddington gets it now from Peru, you know. It's
that's true.
In the vicinity, the South American vicinity.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. But then eventually you get up there and it's absolutely worth it. It's like a sheet of paper. It's just white, 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 as far as you can see. And it's almost like it's sort of, you feel like you're in a U2 album cover or something. You cannot believe your eyes, just white as far as the horizon. And then, having experienced that, and it takes at least a day to drive across or something, but there was one point in the day when you get to a place where when it rains there, which, unlike the Atacama, for some reason it does occasionally rain there, so there is a bit of a lake. The whole thing is actually a dried up inland sea. That's why there's all the salt there. When it rains, the water sits there for a short period of time, but because the water, you have water on top of white salt, it forms a mirror, but not in a way that a lake is like a mirror. It's genuinely like a bathroom mirror. And you look out at it and imagine, and you're on a mirror that seems to stretch to the horizon. And you just can't, and it goes, and it's a, like a bathroom mirror to the horizon, and then some just in the distance on the horizon, some mountains, which you see twice because they're reflected double, and then clouds up and then a few clouds down. It's such a cliche, you can't believe your eyes, but you genuinely can't believe your eyes.
And
you
worth get there, the 3-day trek and the marmalade sandwiches.
It was
then
genuinely worth it. It's one of those things that's absolutely seared in my mind. And I think the water was only a couple of inches thick. So we got, there's a road that went out onto a spit to the end of it. And we all got out, we took photographs of this, and then we got back in the car, and then the driver just drove through it. Across this thing, through the water.
You'd be like, we're going to sink.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it when he set off into it, because I didn't know how deep it was at that stage. That was amazing. And at that point, I believe I didn't stay in it. I think we couldn't afford it. Well, at the far end, there's, I think, a salt hotel. I don't know if it still exists. A hotel literally built from blocks of salt.
Oh, like the ice hotel. Like the ice hotel. Amazing.
There is a salt hotel, I believe, in Bolivia, or was. I don't know if it still exists.
Oh, well, I'd love to chat to you forever. Oh, you live in... that's what I was going to ask you about. You live in Edinburgh, and your wife is Maggie O'Farrell.
Yes.
Is that right?
And in fact, there's a scene in one of her... In This Must Be the Place. I think there's a scene in one of her books, and this was where somebody hits a real low point. Because I was with her on that trip. Where somebody hits a real low point, and they go to Bolivia. I think it's just one chapter, and they're driving on a Jeep. I'm not sure if she mentions the cellar de uni. I think she might do, but it's set right there.
I'm trying to think what I've read, because I've read quite a lot of her books, actually.
She got it into print before I did. So, yeah, there's a scene in one of her books which is kind of inspired by that extraordinary trip we had through Atacama and Bolivia and Altiplano.
That's quite a powerhouse writing family. How does that work when you're sort of sitting together at home writing? Are you sitting at home together writing?
Well, we're both, yeah. Obviously, we've got kids, so we're taking to one of us is writing and one of us is looking after the kids. But it doesn't feel like a powerhouse family. The kids give us very short, so they tell us what to do. So we're in the fourth and fifth most powerful people in the family. They're in charge, really.
You've got three, then. I'm good at counting. I could work that out. Wonderful. Well, my last question is always about music. And actually, one of the real standout moments in Are You Experienced is when you're listening to, not you, obviously, it's not you at all, well, it might be you, actually, because this is quite, it felt like a memory more than anything, because you, I don't know, or maybe you were just conjuring it up. But your character, Dave, is having this incredible train journey, good and bad, and is listening to Comfortably Numb.
Yes.
And there's this great description of the landscape, and you can hear the soundtrack. As a massive music fan myself, I can hear how Comfortably Numb would just be the best soundtrack to listen to on that journey when you're looking out the window and seeing this incredible landscape. First of all, was that an autobiographical moment? And also then I'll ask you about your song that relates to travel. So was it an autobiographical moment?
Not exactly. The song choice was chosen for satirical reasons because it just worked, Comfortably Numb. The idea being, in a way, that's what the whole joke of the book is, in a way, that that's sort of what he's in pursuit of. That he wants to expose himself to things, but he's kind of happiest when he's got... And in a way, that's what music can do when you're travelling. It renders you comfortably numb. I'm going to answer you a whole series of questions backwards actually. I'm a massive music obsessive myself. You know, I play music, I listen to music all the time. One of my favourite things about being a writer is that I can listen to music all the time. I can't really listen to things with lyrics when I'm working, but I listen to jazz and classical. I listen to music almost all, pretty much all the time when I'm working. Sometimes switch it. I can't edit and listen to music for some reason. So I can't don't know why, I can't rewrite with music on. I think because that's lulls off and it's about getting the rhythm of it right. But I find actually writing a first draft where the real challenge is to stop thinking about the school run and the gas bill and this and the other and just to kind of lift yourself out of the everyday world and try and take yourself somewhere else. I find music very useful for that. And all the emails and all the things, distractions and stuff, I find putting music on helps me, especially also electronica, often quite repetitive, simple music. That lifts me out of all of the stuff that's going around in my head, helps me get elsewhere. So I listen to music all the time when I'm writing. And for that reason, I try and avoid music. I almost like need a break for it when I'm travelling. I switch off, actually, despite being, you know, I've got a set of headphones with me today. When I'm out and about in London, I listen to music all the time, except when I'm travelling. And I try and switch off when I'm travelling, because I just want to soak up the sounds, especially if I'm in a different culture. And also because I think travel, I guess it's increasingly in this kind of always on world, travel is your chance. We don't daydream anymore, and it's very important. Mm. And I think to just, I try and disconnect. And again, maybe like I was saying, try and disconnect myself in a way that it was easy to disconnect yourself when you're young. When I'm away, I try not to listen to music and try and daydream, try and do nothing, try and think nothing. Just let everything simmer down in my head and disconnect it. And because all the music I have, I listen, like everybody, you listen to the same thing. So if you're listening to stuff that you've listened to at home, it reminds you of home. So I think lifting yourself out of and just trying to listen to the sounds around you is good when you're travelling. So I try and avoid music when I'm travelling.
If I was going to be nasty and force you to pick a song that reminds you of travel.
A song that reminds me of travel?
A memorable place or time of travel.
Oh, God.
I'll force that Comfortably Numb moment on you, because that was just a great moment in the book.
Again, so ambiently, I was in India. Last time I was in India, I was walking down the street and a wedding party went past of, I'm not sure the name for the style of drumming. Maybe you know, do you know the name of it?
Bangra?
It's a bit like, but well, it's just drumming though. And yeah, it was so, it was about 10 or 20 Indian drummers, and it was really, and it was really joyful. And it was nighttime, but they were carrying around arc lamps, really bright lamps, and there were people really dressed up. And it was this kind of, I don't know how it relates to the sort of wedding traditions of that part of the country. It was in Rajasthan. That's one of those moments, that's what I like about not listening to your own music when you're travelling, when it comes up, because there's something about, we have a sort of oversupply of music, it's used as background everywhere, so actually denying yourself music's right, and then when it appears, and these people just appearing with this amazing, joyful drumming on a random street in Rajasthan one night, and just standing there for as long as I could until they'd gone past, that's my perfect travel music moment, I think.
I'll let you have that because it's a very good moment. So thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast. Do you think I might be able to persuade Maggie to come on as well?
I'll ask her when I get home.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
William, I'm so pleased to have had you on the Big Travel Podcast, and hopefully we will persuade Maggie to come along too. Thank you so much for listening. If you're enjoying the podcast, please go over to iTunes and give us a nice review. I'll be back next week. This time I promise I will actually be back next week. So see you then.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.